SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
Today on Stanford Pathfinders, a professor who says we need to rethink how we give.
It's a different set of preferences, a different set of philanthropic giving choices that wealthy people make than the average person.
An author who wants to change philanthropy.
The wealthier you are, the cheaper it is for you to be virtuous in terms of being a charitable person.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, political science professor Rob Riche. Now here's your host, Howard Wolf.
There are many reasons for Stanford University's success since its founding in 1891. There are the dedicated staff who make the university run and who care so deeply about its mission. There are the legions of amazing faculty members who have expanded the boundaries of knowledge through scholarship and research while teaching the next generation of scholars. There are the hundreds of thousands of students who have not only immersed themselves into all that Stanford has to offer educationally, but also pushed Stanford to change and improve when it faltered. There are Stanford's alumni who have taken the founder's desire to heart and done the best to become useful, educated citizens who become leaders in their fields and devote themselves to the public welfare and the benefit of mankind. And there is the amazing generosity for decades of Stanford's alumni, parents, and friends in terms of their gifts of their time, talents, and treasure to Stanford. This philanthropy is truly unparalleled and something about which the university is justifiably proud. So it is truly fascinating that one of Stanford's own, a Stanford alumnus and current faculty member, has taken on the topic of philanthropy with his new book, Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better. And in so doing, he raises a number of crucial questions in his book, including whether philanthropy, by its very nature, might be a threat to today's democracy, a question that deserves our deep consideration. Rob Riche is a professor of political science at Stanford, faculty co-director for Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society, faculty director of the Digital Civil Society Lab, and faculty director for the Center in Ethics and Society. Rob, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's really great to be here, Howard. Thanks so much for having me.
So the title of your book, Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better, is beyond provocative. So let me ask you this very simple question. Isn't philanthropy, by definition, a good thing? And if not, why?
I don't think philanthropy is just automatically or by default a good thing. And it's for, you know, a couple reasons, but I can boil them down to the following. Big philanthropy in the form of big donations, foundations, kind of, you know, people with a lot of money to give away. That represents, by definition, the conversion or direction of private assets into some public-facing action or influence. And so it's, simply put, an exercise of power by the wealthy. And it's an exercise of power meant to produce some public benefit. But precisely because we live in a democratic society, any place that power is exercised, it deserves our scrutiny so that it serves democratic purposes rather than our automatic gratitude. Sometimes power undermines or is in tension with what we expect in a democracy. And big foundations, almost by definition, are the expression of a plutocratic element in a democratic setting.
So what does plutocratic mean for the listener?
So I don't mean anything pejorative by it. I just mean as a description. It's by definition the preferences of the wealthy. So you don't get to start a big foundation unless you are a very wealthy person. And relative to the vast majority of people, it's a different set of preferences, a different set of philanthropic giving choices that wealthy people make than the average person. If you just looked at the giving preferences of foundations as compared to the giving preferences of all Americans, they are not a mirror image of one another. Vastly different giving preferences.
They give to different sorts of institutions.
Give to very different sorts
efforts.
Of institutions. For example, in the United States last year, more than $400 billion given away from four different sources. Let's just do some descriptive statistics here.
Okay.
Four different sources, living people giving money away like you or I do, or you know, a recent alum giving a bunch of money to Stanford, people who die and make a bequest, corporate giving in the form of a corporate foundation, and then a private foundation you know, like the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation. So four different sources. Giving by living people accounts for more than 70% of all giving. So that's the largest source of all giving in the United States. If you ask, where do living people tend to give their money? The answer is, to me, surprising. It's to religion. It's to the church. It's to the mosque. It's to the synagogue. And not for the social services. This is not the Salvation Army. This is not the Mercy Corps. It's the Sunday plate contribution that you make. The giving that's done by wealthy people very rarely goes to religion. It does in some cases, but it's you know on the order of 15, 20%.
Where does it go?
It goes to higher education. It goes to cultural institutions like museums and things like that. Giving by the wealthy is primarily higher ed, primarily healthcare hospitals. I know it's kind of advanced type of healthcare delivery provision and cultural.
Is that bad?
It's not bad by default. It could be good. It could be bad. I mean, so here's one of the ways which my book, you know, maybe is a bit puzzling. It's a book that's not meant to be advice to people about where is better to give rather than worse to give. It's not a book of moral guidance to a prospective donor. It's a book of political philosophy. I'm a political philosopher by training. And so it's a book that examines the policy structure and the social norms that help orient and shape the giving that happens. So I don't want to really find out from someone, well, I prefer to give to Stanford University as opposed to the soup kitchen, or I prefer to give to the opera instead of the hospital. And then I have a bunch of guidance to give them. It's a book about the policy structure that, in the first instance, allows all of these different organizations to be classified as eligible public charities without any differentiation among them. It's about the tax incentives that attach to all this different giving. And it's about the social norms that generally tend to celebrate giving no matter what, rather than scrutinize it.
So let's assume for purpose of discussion that I buy into your argument that not all giving is good.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how you jump from that to giving being a threat to democracy.
Yeah, good. How can giving be a threat to democracy? So let me give you two examples of that.
Okay.
And I'll start off with just a simple story because this is how I got into this whole project in the first place. Got this great job out here at Stanford, set up shop here as a professor. And a couple of years after being on the faculty here, was in my early 30s, I had my first children, lived here in Palo Alto, and got ready to pack my kid off to kindergarten. So
I've seen this movie. I remember it well.
Yes, exactly. And the thing that surprised me on day one of my oldest kid's first day at public school was getting that, you know, sort of folder of materials that the school district sends home. Welcome to the district. We're so proud to have you here. We're going to have a class act education we're going to provide you. And then a separate piece of paper that said there's this school foundation in Palo Alto and your expected but voluntary contribution this year is $1,000 per child. And I couldn't believe, first of all, that they were asking for a $1,000 contribution. And when I looked into it, I realized that it was to the school foundation in Palo Alto that was meant to support public schools. And it occurred to me, since I had been a scholar in my early career here studying education and school finance, that this was an example of charity that was not addressing disadvantage or addressing poverty. This was an example of Palo Alto charity by well-intentioned people that was exacerbating inequality. It seemed to me common sense and obvious that wealthy people in Palo Alto could afford to give much more charitable money or private dollars to support the public school system than could East Palo Alto, than could the people in San Jose or Oakland or San Francisco. And so I started collecting some data about that. It was exactly as common sense would suggest. People in Palo Alto raise a lot of money to support public schools. People in Woodside raise even more. People in Hillsborough raise a lot too.
Because families move to these areas because oftentimes for the school districts.
For the schools, that's
and
right.
That's part of what makes these schools great.
And it's a community that supports the public school. And they support it in two ways. They pay, relatively speaking, high property taxes.
Yes.
And they also tend to give philanthropically to support the schools on top of it. So it's sort of like philanthropically topping up the public provision of the school in, that you get. And of course, the people in East Palo Alto do not have the same capacity to do that. Why don't they? They have the same permission to. They just don't have as much money. So you can't ask.
So it further exacerbates inequality.
That's right. So we get that. That's reason number one why philanthropy can be in tension with democracy. Because I had thought, consistent with what the ordinary meaning of charity, assistance to the poor, provision for the disadvantaged, almsgiving, that charity was a representation of people who wanted to take their private resources, their money or their time, and then help those who are in need.
Because that's the historical look.
That's the historical look
at charity.
Exactly.
And your book does a phenomenal job of giving the history of charity.
I still, when I give talks about, you know, this book or this topic, I think the average person also does believe that charity means something like assisting the poor or assisting the disadvantaged. And that must be what happens with all of charity in the United States. And it shocked me to find out that it's really not true. So a lot of charity goes to support, you know, people who are already, relatively speaking, advantaged, like the school system in Palo Alto. It turns out that wealthy people give less frequently to support the poor than do middle class and low income people. So the higher up you go in the income scale, the less likely you are.
In terms of acts.
In terms of acts of giving.
Giving.
All right. Well, so that's the first reason why philanthropy might be in tension with democracy. Second reason is much more to do about big donors and foundations. And the book starts with this historical episode that, again, I was really shocked initially to discover because, of course, being here at Stanford and reading the newspapers and all the accounts of the enormous giving by people in Silicon Valley, I was accustomed to the celebratory attitude that people have towards big philanthropists. Surely it has to be a better thing for a person to do to take a huge amount of money and direct it to philanthropy rather than buying a fifth house, a third boat, or you know, an island or something. That has
it
to
seems
be
almost tautologically true.
So
right?
It seems almost tautologically true. You can't possibly think that more private consumption when you're a billionaire is better than philanthropy. All right, so why might that not be true? Here's what I found out. I went back in history and I looked at the creation of the Rockefeller Foundation. So, you know, the Bill Gates, the Mark Zuckerberg of a century ago was John D. Rockefeller. He had amassed the biggest fortune of any American in history at that time. And he wanted to create a different type of charitable trust that would have a global mission. It could give globally, nationally, and locally. He was from New York State. And he wanted it to have a general purpose. So he didn't want it to be just for healthcare, just for education. The mission of the Rockefeller Foundation would be for the advancement of humankind. Now, that's a mission under which you can do almost anything.
But admirable.
But admirable. So he went off to the U.S. Congress in the early 1900s to ask for permission, to ask for legally incorporating the Rockefeller Foundation with a global scope and a general purpose mission. And he was met with extraordinary criticism. And in fact, Congress said no and did not allow him the incorporation papers to create the Rockefeller Foundation. And I read some of the things that were said about Rockefeller. Some of them were about he had earned his money in a corrupt way. So Rockefeller, you know, of course, was the founder of Standard Oil. He was not a friend to unions. And there were people who criticized the manner in which he had produced this mountain of wealth. So, you know, my favorite in terms of a laugh line comment that I unearthed is the head at that time of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, testifying before Congress, said, I think I can reproduce the quote almost directly, something like, "What the world now would gratefully accept from Mr. Rockefeller is the establishment of an endowment that would teach people how in time they can avoid becoming like him." And
it was almost like he was cleansing his ill-gotten gains through the foundation.
That's right. It was sort of a philanthropy that excuses the harms you've done through your capitalist business practices. Now, that was a whole bunch of the criticism, but there was a second type of criticism that was more interesting. And it was the idea that, and here's another passage from these congressional hearings, that philanthropy was a menace to a democratic society, or that philanthropy was repugnant to the whole idea of democracy. You might think, well, how can that be? The answer at the time was, philanthropy represents the effort of a very wealthy person in a setting, a democratic setting, in which we're all politically equal. We're all meant to have an equal opportunity to wield political influence. If I'm a wealthy person, I can't go to you, Howard, and say, you know what? You get to vote in a democracy, but I'd like to purchase your vote, so I have two. That's illegal, even though it would be just an ordinary market exchange if we were to permit it. You might think, I'll be better off if I take $100 from a wealthy person, because what does my vote matter? Not allowed to buy and sell votes. What philanthropy amounts to, some people thought, it was the attempt to give special permission for wealthy people to use their disproportionate resources to try to affect public policy, to try to change the public sphere. And the idea was that there was no way in a democratic society that we should give a special standing to plutocrats to do what we expected citizens to be doing.
So the point here is accountability.
Accountability,
that in
exactly.
a democracy, our elected officials are held accountable, but wealthy people who give away money are not.
I conclude in the book that the private foundation, like the Rockefeller Foundation, like the Gates Foundation, like the Hewlett Foundation, these are amongst the strangest, perhaps the most eccentric institutional forms we have in a democratic society, because they represent the standing invitation to a wealthy person to exercise a disproportionate influence in the public sphere, but without any accountability at all. So give me a minute just to spell this out. Why are foundations unaccountable? So think about a corporation in the marketplace. It's got investors that want a return on their investment. It's got competitors that want to try to put the other company out of business. And it's got consumers that ultimately, if they decide they don't want to buy what's on offer, the company will go out of business. There's an inner logic in the marketplace that unless you meet the test of your investors' pressure, your competitors' competition, or the consumer, you won't be around very long. In public agencies in the democratic government, our elected representatives decide how to spend taxpayer dollars. And if the citizens don't approve of those representatives' decisions, our politicians' decisions, there's an election somewhere down the line. We can vote the people out of office. So there's a responsiveness to democratic citizens through elections. In a foundation, there's no marketplace competition and there's no electoral competition. Foundations are operating in a way which the Rockefeller Foundation can't put the Gates Foundation out of business. There's no such thing as rivals
in foundations. But why would you want to put the Gates Foundation out of business? Because, I mean, so I'm not there with you yet, Rob. So I'm just not there yet. And I read the book and I'm still working on it.
Yeah.
But if Bill and Melinda Gates, through their foundation, want to attack malaria and eradicate malaria from the world, how can that be a bad thing?
I think that's exactly the right sentiment to ask. But let me come to it in a second. I don't want to avoid the question. I want to come to it in a second, because I'm going to take an example which shows the Gates Foundation in a less obviously good light. So domestically, a lot of what the Gates Foundation does is education reform.
Right.
And in that space, some of their preferences around education reform are not shared by ordinary citizens. And so one critic of the Gates Foundation, Diane Ravitch, has said that Bill Gates is the nation's unelected school superintendent. And the reason she says that is Bill Gates has been going around giving lots and lots of money away, his private wealth, although with all kinds of tax advantages that attach to the philanthropy. And you can't unelect Bill Gates. If you don't like Bill Gates' education preferences, what is it you can do as a citizen? Well, as I said, there's no, the Rockefeller Foundation can't put the Gates Foundation out of business. School districts or education reform outfits are basically just supplicants.
But hold on a second. The school district can decide not to accept those funds.
That's true.
Because they are responsible to the citizens that attend their schools.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
No one's twisting their arms.
That's true. So if we think about school districts who have this permission, legal permission to say no, you're absolutely right. But think of the power dynamic here. If you're a cash-strapped school district, or if you're just an ordinary nonprofit and you have suddenly a big donor on the scene, it's oftentimes hard to say no to a big donor and the preferences that they hold. But let's get to your more difficult challenge. I think the malaria case is a really good one. Surely it must be the case.
It must
be the case that the Gates Foundation, if it decides it
wants to tackle malaria. Or whatever foundation.
It wants to tackle malaria. That's got to be a good thing. And, you know, in that particular case, I would agree with you. But it's not because I think there's anything special about malaria. It's that I think that type of approach to solving a global problem in a way which is unlikely to be solved by any other marketplace entity or, in fact, state is exactly what foundations should be doing. So, you know, the book is not just criticism. The book mounts a positive, constructive case for what it is that
there's
foundations
can do. There's a special role for foundations to play in America today.
Correct. I call it a discovery model or a discovery
sort of like
role.
Venture capital.
It is. It shares some similarity to venture capital.
Okay.
It's long-time horizon, risky experiments in social innovation. That's what I think foundations are especially well positioned to provide, because if you harness them to short time horizons, then they're just like a marketplace entity, or they're trying to reproduce what happens in government. Malaria is a great example of something where there's no big incentive for a pharmaceutical company to invest a ton of money in malaria. Why? Because, I mean, on the first instance, the people who would need it basically don't have money to pay for it. So they're not going to get a marketplace return. And well, the governments of the world that have the money to provide for their citizens all types of treatment will indeed do so. But in a place which is in a developing country and malaria is a widespread malady, the government itself doesn't have the money to do it. So that's where the foundation can come in. And if you could actually get at the root of it, you could provide a malaria vaccine, not just a bed net to prevent the malaria from being contracted. Now that would be an incredible contribution, and that's exactly the role I think foundations can play.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More with Stanford professor and author Rob Reich next on Sirius XM Insight 121. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with Stanford professor and author Rob Reich. So let's talk about taxes.
Yep.
Because the listeners always like to hear about taxes.
Always.
But in this case, it's the eradication of taxes, right? So in this country, we provide certain tax benefits for giving. But you seem to have a problem with that.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple problems with them. So let's just first observe that tax advantages for giving have not been a constant feature of American philanthropy. And it's only possible to take a tax deduction for your charitable contribution or for setting up your foundation if there's first an income tax in place for you to deduct your income from. Income taxes have only been around since 1917. So when, you know, the famous Alexis de Tocqueville came to the United States in the 1840s, the Frenchman visiting this incredible new country and said, oh my gosh, it's a nation of joiners. These are the people who like to do for themselves what in other places the government has to do for them. There was all types of giving and volunteering with no tax incentive to do so because there was no income tax. Andrew Carnegie, John Rockefeller created their respective charitable entities with no tax incentive to do so at all. So that's the first observation. There's no obvious reason to think that America's distinctive capacity to do things on its own as like a nation of joiners needs a tax incentive for you to get out of your bed in the morning to do something.
So doing away with the tax incentive for giving would not change giving at all?
Well, that's an empirical question because now that we have it in place, maybe people have become accustomed to it and they, in fact, might change their behavior. So it's an open question. That's not a philosophical question, but an empirical one. But here's some evidence to suggest that.
I asked an empirical question of a philosopher.
That's good. We like them. We like empirical questions too, although we're not the ones often to provide definitive answers to them.
I'll go get in touch with an economist.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let me give you one other reason to think about the tax structure as potentially problematic. It's a wonky response. So for all the listeners out there who have actually paid taxes rather than your 18 or 19-year-old here at the university, this will be familiar. But if you haven't actually filled out tax forms, this will just be pretty obscure. The instrument that's used for American charity is a tax deduction, a deduction of money from your otherwise taxable income. So let's say that you make $500,000 a year, Howard, and I make $2 million a year.
I like your assumptions off the bat.
Both of which are, I'm sure, factually speaking, untrue. But let's make it easier. Let's make $100,000 for me and, call it $500,000 for you. Let's assume that I make $100,000. That puts me in the 30% tax bracket. $500,000 for you puts you in the 40% tax bracket.
Okay.
Okay. Now, what it means, if you make a $1,000 gift to Stanford University, you deduct $1,000 from your income, so it's $499,000 of taxable income rather than $500,000. I make the same $1,000 gift to Stanford University, the identical amount we've given to the identical nonprofit, Stanford, so presumably the identical social good has been produced. There's no difference in terms of our respective gifts. And I deduct the $1,000 from my income, $100,000, I get taxed on $99,000. Now, what that means is that you're effectively paying only $600 of that $1,000 gift because you're in the 40% tax bracket.
Got it.
$400 of your taxes is otherwise forgiven. I make the $1,000 gift, but I'm in the 30% tax bracket. It only costs me, or it costs me $700, and $300 is given. So the richer you are, the less it costs for you actually to make a donation. Or to put it differently, the wealthier you are, the cheaper it is for you to be virtuous in terms of being a charitable person.
And you think that's wrong?
It seems to me a very strange tax structure, a very strange public policy that amplifies the benefits for the wealthy as opposed to providing greater benefit to the poor. When, after all, as any economist would tell us, the marginal utility of the millionth dollar for the millionaire is much less than it would be for someone who has $100,000. So why is it more expensive for me to give as a poor person than it is for a wealthy person? That seems nonsensical to me.
And what would you do to change that?
Right. So the proposal I make in the book is that we should get rid of tax-deductible giving entirely, partly because it's unclear whether it's actually necessary to stimulate people to give money, even though I think empirical evidence shows that there is, for certain types of giving, some genuine sensitivity to the existence of an incentive. Although, just to put a footnote here, it's to the best of the empirical evidence that I've been able to amass, particular for certain organizations like Stanford, is very good at instructing people who would like to give how to tax optimize, so to speak. So too with other large institutions. But giving to religion, which remember, as I said, accounts for nearly half of all giving, is pretty insensitive to whether there's a tax advantage. People are not thinking to themselves on Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning, how much of a tax break am I getting here by giving to my
church? They're not registering their $20 bill that they put in the cup.
Correct. So my bet would be if we got rid of the tax deduction entirely and had no incentive for giving, giving to religion would basically be unchanged, but giving to cultural institutions and higher education would go down. What would I change it to, get rid of the tax deduction? I would put an identical flat tax credit in place. The tax credit would be treating us equally. Bill Gates, let's just say it's a $2,000 tax credit. He gets his $2,000 tax credit. So when he makes a charitable gift, some amount of it is matched up to $2,000 by a tax credit. You do the same. I do the same. When we're done with our tax credit, if we've used it all up, you're still free to give. So Bill Gates can continue to set up whatever philanthropic entity he wants and continue to give money away on his own dime. But the $2,000 is made equally available to all of us. Instead of having, as we have now, a plutocratic bias baked into the tax code itself, in which the availability of this tax instrument to stimulate charitable giving is used hugely by the wealthy and very rarely by the poor, amplifying the preferences of the wealthy and diminishing the preferences of charitable giving of the middle class and the poor.
Rob, thanks for being on the show.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on Sirius XM Insight. Listen to this and other episodes anytime on demand with the Sirius XM app.